Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When John McCain and Barack Obama speak to U.S. voters, what do those voters actually hear? While Americans report serious concerns about the war, the economy, and the environment, and expect their next president to change what troubles them, my guest today is convinced that the winning candidate will be the one who appeals to voters' emotions as well as their intellects. So how are the candidates and the party machines that support them talking about the things that matter most? Frank Luntz has directed thousands of polls and surveys for clients ranging from GOP candidates to television networks to airlines. He is best known for divining the exact words and phrases that elicit the strongest audience reaction and then systematically pushing those terms into Americans' daily conversations. Just in time for Election 08, Luntz has updated his 2007 book and re-released it in paperback. It's called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. Frank, welcome back to Think.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
You have said that Barack Obama will rock the world. What makes him better at communicating in a campaign than John McCain?
He's very aspirational. And when you listen to him, you feel better about the country. You feel better about yourself. It's unifying. It's uplifting. And it's Kennedy-esque in its vision of the future. And his delivery is, quite frankly, fantastic. It's not. I know the book is called Words That Work, but you could also add delivery that works, because he is at ease when he's delivering a speech, much more so than John McCain.
That's got to be harder for you as a consultant. You can tell people what to say, but telling them how to say it must be much tougher.
Well, it's not tough for me in that term, because I can't tell someone what to think. I have no problem telling them, after they tell me what they think, how to communicate that.
So, in other words, you don't set the policy for them. They just say, here's what I want to say, and tell me how to say it the best.
This is what I believe in. This is why I believe it. What's the best way for me to communicate those beliefs?
So Obama and McCain still are pretty much in a dead heat in the polls. So he's got to be doing something right, John McCain, in getting his message across.
Yes, and if you'd interviewed me 6 weeks ago, I would have said on the air that Barack Obama is going to be the next president. After watching what's happened since Obama's return from Europe, where he was fantastic, watching the visuals that came out of the Middle East, where he was impressive, and to see that his numbers didn't go up one iota. And in fact, John McCain has actually closed the gap since that fantastic trip. It says to me that there's something deeply important out there, and that's the subtitle of the paperback. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. Obama is talking in a very positive, a visionary way, but there aren't specifics to much of what he's saying, and he's not closing the deal. He may be thinking that he's communicating something that's presidential, but apparently a majority of Americans are listening to it, and they haven't responded to it yet, even though he's clearly more popular and has a greater potential for votes than John McCain does.
So there has to be something essentially attached to the catchphrase.
It may be the candidate himself. We don't talk about it anymore because the word experience has just been so pilloried. And yet, he is the least qualified candidate running for president in decades, perhaps even in the 20th century. And just maybe that may not have had an impact in the Democratic primary, but that it's having an impact with general election voters, and that even the best words can't overcome the sense of lack of experience. Now, let me just say one more thing. I do still think Obama wins, but I do believe that his candidacy is not as strong today as it was, say, 4 weeks ago.
Who came up with the phrase, maybe you know this, third Bush term?
I don't know who came up with it, but it's a very impressive phrase because there's a visualization there. When you say George Bush, ask people, what do you think? They see him in cowboy boots. They see him like a Texan, and it's a negative visualization. And I realize that for Texas NPR listeners, yours may be a more balanced audience. But in Texas, Bush remains popular, but for the rest of the country, he's not. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to make you think Bush, McCain, Bush, McCain, Bush, McCain, so that you are not voting for John McCain, you are, in fact, voting for... 4 against George Bush, and that vote would be 2-1 against McCain. So it's a smart strategy, but here's the problem with that. In 2004, that's the same campaign John Kerry ran against George Bush. Well, on Election Day, a majority of Americans did not think Bush deserved to be reelected. I think it was, I believe it was 48%, and yet he won 51% of the vote. Kerry was successful in challenging Bush's pedigree, but he never made a case for himself, and so he lost.
One of the things that people have said is really important for John McCain to do is to reach out to those conservative Christian voters who might have preferred a different primary candidate, and now they have McCain in the Republican side. What does he need to do, without being sort of disingenuous in terms of the way he expresses his own faith, to communicate with those voters?
Well, it's interesting that Obama would not be the natural choice of evangelicals and born-agains, and yet he is very much at ease talking in a religious tone. John McCain, who himself is religious, is very private about his religiosity and doesn't like articulating that in a public forum. So that's why I believe Obama went to Jim Warren's church, because he saw a chance to use that lexicon of religion, of spirituality, that he actually might get a leg up on John McCain. Most people that I've talked to who've watched it felt that McCain outperformed Obama. Some people thought that was expected because it is McCain's home crowd in terms of being leaning Republican. But with Obama's language advantage, I would have thought he would have done better there.
What do you make of the accusations that McCain was perhaps able to hear Obama as he was driving over there in a limousine?
I don't believe it, because we would know that already. We would know that by now.
Because you'd be able to tell from having listened, or it would have come out?
They've asked him directly, and he said he wasn't in a cone of silence, but I didn't hear the questions.
My guess
and even so, the stories that John McCain told, that's one of the things I don't like about politics. He performs well, so they find an excuse. Whether you heard the questions or not, define marriage. It's a two-word question. They should have an answer for it. What is rich? Define rich. These are very simple questions. And Obama had trouble answering them because I think in his mind, he's so concerned about the words that he uses. And the new chapter in the paperback version, and that's what I'm obviously promoting, I spend a lot of time on Obama's language because it is so incredible, so positive, and so Bobby Kennedy-esque. But I think that he's in these forums that he tries so carefully to choose each word that it ends up meaning less than what it otherwise would. That he, I don't know if it's insecurity or concern. John McCain just comes out with the answer. And for better or worse, what the American people want today is someone who says what they mean and means what they say. And John McCain gave off that. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that he heard the questions. He said nothing different in his presentation than he said in other forums just like this.
Frank Luntz is my guest. His book, now out in paperback, is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. I'm glad you brought up Bobby Kennedy, because we actually just did a show yesterday that was about his 1968 Democratic primary run, in which he was really famous for showing up and specifically challenging the audience that he had come to speak to. He would talk to medical students and say, you're going to be responsible for changing health care in this country. He would point the finger at housewives and business people and all kinds of individuals. I'm wondering if you think, Frank, that we'll ever return to a place. Americans may say that they want to be spoken to by someone honestly, but will we ever get back to a place where a candidate can be less careful in terms of speaking as he runs for office and say candidly what he thinks is wrong in the country?
That is the $64,000 question. And since I haven't been in a, whatever they call those chambers.
The cone of silence.
Cone of silence. That is so funny to me. Everyone now knows that phrase, just like people learned the phrase lockbox in 2000. We won't go back to it. Newt Gingrich was the last candidate that really wanted a national dialogue. They wanted a public discussion about these key issues. And he was pilloried for it. He was destroyed. when you say that everything should be on the table for Social Security, as John McCain says, that's a tremendous risk. That he might come, that he might talk about cutting Social Security benefits. You know what Barack Obama would do to him if he ever said it. And yet we know that that's one of the major solutions. That if they talked about raising taxes, either on Social Security benefits or on the recipients themselves, we don't live in a society where you can have these conversations. And that is one of the tragedies of the American political system. And what I admire, and again, I have to say he's not as good a communicator, but what I admire about John McCain is another, is one of those words I added to the to Words That Work that I didn't have in the first edition, which is the word consequences. John McCain will talk about the consequences of policies. It's a more mature discussion because you really get to hear both sides. Obama will tell you where he stands, will tell you what's wrong with McCain, but doesn't give you the full picture of the consequences of the policies that he advocates.
Now, of course, you point out that the consequences can be either negative or positive, but many people hear that word and they immediately assume that, it's attached to something that's bad.
Exactly. They assume the worst. They pay attention. George Bush was losing the debate on Iraq. In fact, he's lost the debate on Iraq with one exception. They don't approve of his policies. They don't approve of us still being there. But when you ask the question, should we pull troops out before finishing the mission or before victory is clear? When he used the word the consequences of early withdrawal, even people who opposed the policies agreed with him on that message. And he used the word consequences in his speech, and it worked. It changed the whole dynamic of the Iraq debate.
We're not hearing as much from McCain or perhaps from the reporters who are covering him these days, the phrase straight talk, as we did certainly the first time he ran or earlier in the primary. Did that phrase just essentially outlive its usefulness, do you think?
It's because he's a different candidate now. And I think that that's one of the reasons why. I think that he's not as candid as he was in 2000. I don't think his campaign is as good as it was in 2000. I think John McCain in 2000, I can't do an analogy to voters who are older, because maybe Reagan in 76 is like John McCain in 2000. And in 2008, he's been much more careful, much more cautious in what he says. And so that so-called Straight Talk Express doesn't quite sound as appropriate as it did in 2000.
So he may not be the candidate he was in 2000. And in your mind, he's less of a candidate. But is this to his political advantage, actually?
Well, once again, I have to say I don't... I'm not impressed with the media in terms of its willingness to allow candidates to be perfectly candid. You've got people, great writers, great journalists like Joe Klein, Jeff Greenfield, and I'm trying to think, there are a couple others, that really encourage the candidates to be forthcoming with what they actually believe and to engage in these kinds of intellectual discourse. And then the moment they do, they're on the front page of the New York Times, votes or wants to raise taxes on Social Security or wants to cut benefits to seniors, and they all pay a political price.
So we play gotcha, basically.
We play gotcha journalism. That's what I loved about Saturday Night. It was the first forum that I've seen where the questions elicited honest responses, candid responses, but you didn't have that back and forth, the accusations of hypocrisy.
Frank Luntz is my guest. His book is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is pollster and political consultant Frank Luntz. His book is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. It's just been updated and re-released in paperback. If you want to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
And by the way, I am particularly interested in hearing those comments. I enjoy the give and take. So much of the book's language comes from focus groups where average Americans participate and they offer their points of view. And probably three-quarters of the book and almost all of the new introduction comes from those conversations. And so they'll see their own words in there.
One thing that I think is really interesting about the way you do things is that although clearly you have a talent for coming up with these phrases, you don't put anything out there until you have just tested the heck out of it with real people.
I listen. Some people call me a wordsmith. The truth about my profession is that I'm very good at hearing great words and then using them. I'm good at listening to what people react to and then applying that. And so I'm not really a crafter of language. Peggy Noonan is a brilliant speechwriter. I don't do that. Ted Sorensen on the Democratic side, and I've got some of their words in the book. What I have done is my words tend to be much more pedestrian of average everyday Americans in average everyday situations. And from there, I will apply things that people will nod their heads. They will not burst into tears. They will not jump for joy. They will nod their heads in agreement. That's kind of where I'm at.
Have you gotten better through the years, though, at predicting what will fly and what's not going to work?
Yes, and in fact, some of my focus groups are very boring for me because in a typical three-hour session, and I like that amount of time because that lets me get inside people's heads, I'd say 90% of what I write tests incredibly well. I did a project for the Gates Foundation on education, and there were 11 different paragraphs. I did a project for a home, what do you call it, a retail establishment that does home improvement. And in every single case, the language I had was better than the language that they had. That's actually boring for me because I'm applying what I've learned, but I'm not learning anything. And the question is, am I a good teacher in words that work? Do I explain it well? That I don't know. I have never thought that I'm a great writer, but I do know that people will learn from the book how to get out of a speeding ticket, how to make up with your spouse, how to get on a plane after the door is shut, how to get into a restaurant that's incredibly overbooked. I know this from having researched it for the last 15 years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Frank Luntz is on the line. Let's speak to Pete in Arlington. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Luntz, I think that you do have a great talent. What I'm thinking, as I was listening to you talk a moment ago, you said that unfortunately the political dynamic or environment in the country is such that politicians just simply can't either bring up certain subjects or say certain words that would make the dialogue more realistic. Question is, are you familiar with the movement that's underway? It's a joint project between the Concord Coalition, which is a bipartisan group, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. He was the Secretary of Commerce under Nixon, and a filmmaker who has made a movie called IOUSA. And the point of the movie is our national debt is $53 trillion and growing. They're hoping it will be to the national debt awareness what Al Gore's movie was to the awareness of global warming. And they're timing the release of the movie late September specifically to try to force the candidates to speak candidly about this subject. What do you think of that effort, and do you think that not only what people say, but who's doing the saying can make a difference? And I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you very much.
Thanks,
Pete. I'm actually part of that effort, and that movie is going to be playing this Thursday night in a number of theaters across America. I think there are 13 different cities that are having a special screening, and then those participants that he mentioned, as well as Warren Buffett, is going to be participating in a panel discussion afterward. It's a really fantastic opportunity to hear from people who understand the whole deficit problem, and it's a great film. The challenge is, when will any of these politicians actually step up the plate and say, we can't spend anymore? If we're being honest, how do we afford a prescription drug benefit plan? How do we afford universal health care? How do we afford the war in Iraq? You know, we'll take Republicans and Democrats alike. Everyone's got spending programs because the American people keep saying, give me more. But nobody wants to pay for them. And in the end, we've created this deficit that's out of control. And so while the media will hold candidates accountable for deficits, they won't really score the promises that they are making, because if they did, they would be very angry at one of the presidential candidates right now. I'm not going to tell you which one, but I think you could figure it out.
Frank, do you think that we've become sort of childlike and unable to accept reality, or is this lack of candid talk about the problems that the country faces, is that an outgrowth maybe of the movement toward political correctness?
Oh, God, that's great. I think you learn as a student in college to be very careful about what you say. I bet there's half of your listening audience right now could think of a time when they were in school where they were graded down because they gave an opinion that their professor didn't like. So you learn that at an early age. Then you go into your 20s and you get your first job and you disagree with your employer and suddenly you find that you're behind the eight ball. So you learn it again. By the time you get into politics in your 40s and 50s, you've already realized that you can't say what you mean and you don't always mean what you say because there's a punishment for that. And I go back to Newt Gingrich because, for whatever his faults, he is the most brilliant political philosopher of our generation. And he is the most innovative, and he's had plenty of partnerships with Democrats and progressives. And yet he was demonized for the comments that he made about Social Security, about Medicare, and about a lot of other issues. It just doesn't pay.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Frank Luntz is on the line. His book is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris and Frank. For the last few years, we've kind of been set up to have the big issues as the discussion in this election, the war or occupation in Iraq, you know, universal health care, you know, versus a socialized medicine, whatever you want to call it. We've had big issues. Now, as we're getting into the stretch run of the campaign, and based on the forum on Saturday, we have a new euphemism, human rights for the unborn. And now we're talking about how do you defeat evil? It seems that at the end of each campaign, we go from the big issues to these, you know, they've been called wedge, they've been called whatever, but they're not priority issues for, you know, the strategic future of America. And, Frank, I'm wondering how you took that, to me, the new euphemisms of human rights for the unborn and talking about this, you know, can you defeat evil, much like can you, you know, defeat the evildoers in Iraq, how you felt that language was being used.
Well, it's interesting. Don't hang up, because I'll give you an answer, and then I want to get your reaction to me. I never liked the word evil bothers me, because I think it is so pejorative. I think it is deliberately meant to incense, and that it's, I understand why it is used. I don't think that it is constructive to the conversation. In terms of human rights for the unborn, my issue actually comes before that. There was a time when you were pro-life or pro-choice. And so both sides could make the case that the language for them was supportive. Whether you're pro-life or pro-abortion, anti-abortion, whatever that is, you're pro-life, pro-choice, it made you pro-something. Over the last 3 years, it has become pro-choice or anti-choice. And you know that anti-anything is automatically going to give people a negative impression. And so to me, that issue of human rights for the unborn is a way to get around the new language of anti-choice, when the question, and I think a better description, is the way that it was pro-life. If you are, you have to put both sides on an even footing and then let the public decide. So I think that the reason why we've moved in that direction of human rights for the unborn is because people have not been allowed the pro-life moniker, which I think is a perfectly appropriate way to describe their position. What's your reaction to what I just said?
No, I agree, because I felt that up until the forum with the advertisements on CNN, I thought Rick Warren was going to be somewhat objective and neutral. But it seemed in his formulation of the questions and the language he used, he set up the questions on a tee for McCain and wanted to put Obama on his heels with the language he used. And by using that, like I said, I thought it was more, you know, incendiary language, you know, that kind of, like I said, put the slant towards the right wing or towards McCain.
Well, here's the thing. Those, again, one of the things I said earlier is that Obama speaks. I'll tell you a story, which is how McCain communicated on Saturday night. I'm a commentator for Fox, and I read a passage that was very spiritual, very overtly religious, and I had people react to it on a second-by-second basis, whether they agreed or disagreed. This is all done on live television, so there's no editing tricks. And as I read the religious passage, the Republicans reacted positively and the Democrats reacted negatively. And by the time I was done, the Republicans loved it and the Democrats hated it. Then I played who actually said it. Remember, the first time they heard it, they only heard it from me. Then they watched who said it, and it was Barack Obama. And everybody started laughing, and nobody would look me or the camera in the eye because they were so embarrassed. So when I continued and I played the next part of what Obama said about religion, the Republicans hated it, and the Democrats loved it. The language hadn't changed. It's that they saw the speaker was different than who they expected. And so what we will accept from someone that we like, even if we disagree with a policy, we will reject from someone that we don't like, even if we agree with what they're saying. It was an incredible experiment, and I'm surprised it did not get more play, because it really gets into the psyche of how we react to things.
Well, it speaks to the cult of personality, doesn't it? That ultimately we are gravitating toward the individual that we think we like as opposed to the ideas.
That is correct, but it also, you know, frankly, it also says that we're hypocrites, that we like it from people. We will like things that we dislike if they're given to us by people we like.
Well, let me push you on that a little bit, because you mentioned earlier that what we need to do, and I guess you mean collective we as Americans, is put both sides of an issue on equal footing. For example, the pro-choice, pro-life. Is that something that you've ever strived to do when you've been working for a client?
No, I don't. That's the one issue that I've stayed away from, because I don't believe that there is common ground. I don't believe that you can have a fair discussion. And I believe that any conversation that way, on that issue of abortion and on most of these social issues, do not lend themselves to compromise. And so I try to stay away from it. In words that work, and even in the updated paperback, I still stayed away from the social issues. And I think I've got one paragraph which says, we can't find common ground, so let it go.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Frank Luntz is here. His book is called Words That Work. Let's go next to Hussein in Garland. Hi, Hussein.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for a good show. And you fill up Glenn Mitchell's shoes very good.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. If he was alive, he would have been proud of you.
Thank you.
And my comment is about Mr. McCain's audience were the religious right people. So he told them what they want to hear. That's why his answers were ready. As soon as they asked him, what life started at conception, just like very simple. But Obama tried to talk to the whole country. He was trying to not offend anybody, and that's very hard. And the problem with the media is they rather kill the messenger than the listen to message. And they are always, as you guys said, it says, we got you. Why you change your mind? But nobody's talking about, Obama said, we need to talk about enemies. also, so we can maybe find a political solution. In Iraq, it worked, but everybody sees what just the surge, number of American soldiers. They never say, well, we paid the Sunni people, we hired them to. They don't talk about that. So this is the problem with the also as American. We want it both ways. And as at one time, at one hand, we complain about China, but on the other hand, our favorite story is Walmart. It's all Chinese product.
Hussein, you brought up some really interesting points, and we just have a little time before the break, so I want to give Frank a chance to respond. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
You can't accuse John McCain of pandering when he says what he believes and that he gets right to the point. To me, pandering is someone who tries to skirt the issue, takes forever to answer a question because he knows that what he really believes will agitate the audience. That's pandering. And as far as Iraq, I do believe that there is, and that's where the word consequences comes in, I do believe that there is a way linguistically to help bridge the gap. But those on the right and those on the left aren't seeking to bridge the gap. They're seeking to exploit it. And that's one of the problems that we have in the political system today. The fringe movements want to divide America. They don't want a compromise. They don't want cooperation.
Why is there no power in the middle anymore?
There is power in the middle, and that's why both candidates have been running to the middle. John Edwards was on the left on the Democratic side, and Republicans are three candidates on the right. I think McCain is a centrist Republican. It's not as clear where Obama stands, but that's because he hasn't been in office as long. But the middle doesn't have the intensity, it doesn't have the passion, and nobody stands in line for 3 hours to go see a speech by a moderate. They stand in line for a conservative or a progressive, but not a moderate.
Frank Luntz is my guest. We're talking about his updated book, Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frank Luntz. His book is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Frank, how effectively do these guys use humor on the campaign trail?
Oh, please. Every time John McCain tells a joke, I hear votes just disappear. He's got a couple of good ones. The best one of all, the one that actually helped restore his position in the campaign, was where he talked about Hillary Clinton's $1 million pork barrel earmark to fund a museum for Woodstock. McCain says that I'm sure it was a pharmaceutical moment, but I wasn't there. I was tied up at the moment. And everyone laughs and then cheers, and then gives him a standing ovation, because obviously, while some Americans were enjoying Woodstock, John McCain was in a prisoner of war camp. He has another one where he talks about bears and paternity suits, where he doesn't know if it's that they spent thousands of dollars to search for the mating habits of bears. He doesn't know if it's a crime or a paternity suit. It's not there. That's okay also, but he got into trouble. He said $5 million. He didn't mean it as a number for being rich, but he was trying to be flip, and he paid a price for it. Most of these candidates aren't funny, and they should just stick to the issues and not try to be entertainers.
Yeah, what happens in this YouTube world where one joke, it's very obvious that they use it in every city. And I think, you know, even though we've had national coverage for a long time now, people haven't been as aware as they are right now that the same speech gets used in every place.
No, they're not aware. And even those who follow politics, and that was my point about McCain when you asked earlier, that, well, did he get the questions ahead of time? But it doesn't affect him because John McCain says the same thing, whether it's 8 a.m. in Dallas, Texas, or 8 p.m. in Manchester, New Hampshire. You know where he stands. And I think that the American people would be bored. They wouldn't be angry if they learned that, but they would be bored. By the way, one of the rules, 10 rules in Words That Work, novelty. That if you really want to get people to pay attention to what you're saying, you've got to give them something new and different each time you speak to them. And that's a challenge for these presidential candidates because they don't want to keep crafting something new.
It's got to be hard to memorize something new if they're constantly thinking of something different. I mean, they're out there. They're under a huge amount of time pressure.
Correct. And that makes it that much more difficult.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Irving. Hello, John.
Yes. Mr. Luntz, your analysis fascinates me, and that's a good part. But I have to ask you a question that is just a little bit of a scolding. It seems that euphemism is pervasive now. I don't know if it's increased, but it seems it has. I get it at the dentist office. I get it at work. I certainly get it at politics. And Ms. Boyd mentioned a couple of yours, what I call euphemisms, at the top of the program, oil exploration instead of drilling or mining, or death tax instead of inheritance tax. Do you feel as if you've helped push us toward the use of euphemisms? And if so, do you have a bit of a twinge of regret in that?
Well, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
When you pay that tax, the so-called death tax, what triggers you paying it?
Well, I, as a dead person, do not pay it. My estate pays it.
Okay, but what is the event that triggers that tax?
Well, I see your point, but rouse people against it instead of asking them, well, do you prefer, on the whole, an income tax, an inheritance tax?
You pay an income tax?
Instead of asking about tax policy, it's inflaming against a particular tax policy. So it's not a nuanced discussion of all the range of possible possibilities.
Sir, what do you call the tax on what you earn?
Of course, it's an income tax.
What do you call the tax when you buy something? When a store sells something to you, what is that tax when you buy it?
A purchase or sales tax.
Well, it's not called a purchase. It's called a sales tax.
Well, sure.
And when you purchase a home or you own a home and you pay a tax on that, what's that called?
Property.
Okay. And when you die, I mean, it's
when you inherit money, what do you call that tax?
It's what
inheritance tax. The person who pays it has inherited it.
Well, there is a question.
You and I will not come to an agreement on that.
Well, probably not. But I mean, my real question was one: do you feel somewhat responsible for euphemism out there?
I know that the words that I have they are words that work. I mean, the title of the book is what is supposed to be inside, and that if the goal is clarity, for example, in Congress they used to call it the Armed Services Committee. What the heck is armed services? It's national security. So call it what it is. And I believe that we have had a shortage of straightforward communication that communicates exactly what you're doing. Exploring for energy is far closer in what they're talking about in Anwar than drilling for oil. Drilling for oil makes people think of those rigs from the 1920s and black goo gushing up from the ground, and it's nothing of the kind. Exploring for energy in the year 2008 is scientific, it's highly technical, and the amount that's disturbed from the earth rises about 3 feet off the ground, and it is a pipe that is probably smaller than the water pipe that takes water into your house. It is certainly smaller than a telephone pole outside your house. So my job is to clarify and simplify and be straightforward. And that's, I think, why those words work so well.
I don't want to get too hung up on this, but isn't the death tax, as you call it, really only applicable to a very small percentage of Americans who die?
It's right, and it is only applicable when someone dies. You don't pay a death tax if you're wealthy, you don't pay a death tax as long as that person's alive.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Frank Luntz is my guest. Let's go next to Barry in Dallas. Hello, Barry.
Hi. I want you to comment on something. I'm going to, let's say, the term political correctness, it seems like everything that falls under that term is actually deception, because all these little things that everybody wants to use and cover with the term political correctness are contrary to one's natural thought and spirit, it seems like to me. So I call it deception in place of truth, anything that comes under the heading of political, so-called political correctness the last 35 years. What do you think?
Can you give me an example? Because I don't know how to answer your question without.
Well, it's politically correct to be green these days, according to the Al Gore bunch. Okay, I think it's more politically correct to let God do His thing on this earth, like He's always done since He created it. So, from the standpoint of my personal spirit of freedom within me and in God, contrary to fear under Al Gore, I prefer the spirit of freedom. And I call that more politically correct than the way the Democrats and liberals have coined that term political correctness and fomented on all of our culture for the last 35 years.
Well, the issue for me is in the freedom to be able to disagree and not be punished for it, that academia should welcome diversity not just by race or gender, but also by political thought. Tragedy is that it does not, and that the industry that is most responsible for creativity, Hollywood, should welcome diversity of thought. It is easier to come out of the closet as gay or lesbian in Hollywood than it is to come out of the closet as a Republican. If you're Ellen DeGeneres, you will be celebrated. They will hold dinners to you. If you come out as a Republican, you will find that you will lose your job in places. All that I seek, whether they call it political correctness or some other phrase, is that people can hold different points of view, argue sharply about it, shake hands, and agree to be civil and decent to each other and respect alternative points of view. And the tragedy is that we don't have that in so many areas of America today. I'm hoping that these debates are as civil as the forum was last Saturday night.
You do a lot of consulting in Europe for different entities, candidates, and companies. Can you talk about their perspective on this campaign and what they're listening for?
Yes, they're fascinated. When they started selling Words to Work in Britain, they had 2,000 copies, and it sold out in very few days, because everybody wants to hear about what's going on, and they are absolutely enthralled with Barack Obama. If Europe was to vote right now, Obama would take probably 65, maybe even 70% of the vote. And it's not that it's not his position on Iraq, it's not that he's a Democrat, it's that they hear him, and he is intriguing to them. You can get a free cab ride in Italy if you're willing to spend the 15 minutes talking about what Obama's really like.
Obama's youth, at least relative to John McCain, seems to be an advantage for him in attracting young voters in this country and apparently also in Europe. Could McCain use language to seem younger, or would that make him look ridiculous?
I think McCain has to be John McCain. I think that's the most important thing, is that so-called straight talk, mm-hmm. that he just says it the way it is, and that he stops using a teleprompter, and that he starts engaging people in those town hall meetings. That's where he's best. The man's prepared for 35 years to be president, and he's not going to make himself look or sound younger by changing his language. He celebrates his 72nd birthday in a week's time. That's life. That's where he's at. And his responsibility over the next 75 days is to prove to people that at 72 years of age, he's not too old, and that he has the necessary wisdom to be president.
Let's speak next to Adam in Arlington. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I know you don't have much time left, so I'll keep it quick. But we're speaking of euphemisms and calling things they're really not. I was wondering if your guest could discuss the use of the word war by every politician and every news organization to describe the conflict in Iraq, which has never been formally declared a war. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
It's interesting because I think no one expected it to be over as quickly as it was. No one expected to come back the way that it did. And that's a constitutional issue that I think the next president will have to deal with. People saw that whether it was declared a war or not, you ask people, was Iraq a war? 80% of Americans would say yes. So that's a case where what you call it doesn't matter. The reality is more important than the words used to describe it. And I think that, I don't know how to answer just beyond that.
I want to talk in the last minute or two about the Bush administration, which has to have been an interesting one for you to observe, given what you do for a living. You have this very plain-spoken leader, some would say inarticulate, but an extraordinary amount of message discipline from within the administration and from the president himself. Where is the fulcrum between those two things?
It's interesting to me that his State of the Union speeches were, for the most part, very powerful and effective, and yet his press conferences were very halting. That his off-the-cuff remarks more often than not did him damage, and his formal remarks were very powerful. I don't know of a president that had a greater dichotomy in terms of his communication. He had a vice president who everyone saw as competent and focused, but was so demonized over the years because he appears humorless. They asked him a question, which just blew me away. Cheney, the American people oppose this war. How can you support it? And Cheney's response was, so? In one word, people heard that and just, I'm sure they turned off to the administration. It explains why his popularity is as low as it is. And yet it looks like in Iraq, he may have been right. And I'll conclude on one point. He said early on after 9/11 that the way you will define his administration is whether or not he can keep this country safe. Well, since 9/11, there's not been a single successful terrorist attack on American soil. He was wrong. That is not how they've defined his presidency. But if they took him at his word, then he actually has been a success.
Frank Luntz has been my guest. The book is called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. It is updated and now out in paperback all over the place. Frank, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.